It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, are you an ENFP? Well, our guest says, who cares? He makes the case against a widely used personality test that a lot of businesses and other organizations rely on.
But first, a peaceful protest turned violent last night in Ferguson, Missouri, after local police shot to death a black unarmed teen on Saturday.
Police say the shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown was the result of the youth assaulting an officer in a police car. Residents and some local witnesses say it was a case of excessive police force.
Some people see parallels between this case and the Trayvon Martin shooting in 2012. Chad Dion Lassiter is with us now. He's a professor of race relations at the University of Pennsylvania and sits on the board of trustees for the Philadelphia prison system. Chad, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this all started on Saturday when an 18-year-old named Michael Brown, recent high school graduate, was shot to death by a police officer. Details are still emerging, but what do we know so far?
What we know is that this is a textbook example of how not to handle various situations. What we also see is that there seems to continue to be this conflict between the police and young African-American males. And more often than not, it ends with African-American males losing their lives, be that Trayvon Martin, even though that was George Zimmerman, but we have Eric Garner, most recently at the hands of the police in New York. We have Oscar Grant at the hands of the BART transit police out in Oakland. And it just seems to me that it seems to be an open season on police or some police officers engaged in excessive force as it relates to looking at some black males in a very intimidating fashion. It always amazes me at how police are the ones who are saying that they felt threatened when, in fact, they're the ones that have the guns.
Well, the local NAACP in Missouri is echoing what you're saying in large part, saying this is a dire concern in light of Trayvon Martin's death and a string of others. What do you see as being at stake in this particular case?
I think what's going to be at stake in this particular case is that we have the potential to highlight how we can better engage communities of color and not buy into the stereotypes and the myths that some within the police department have as it relates to black males and the imagery that goes around that. I think what we also need to look at is that the outpouring of concern that has boiled over to some of the frustration is because the communities, so often or not, have looked at things from a historical standpoint, and they see the challenges of police brutality, not only in St. Louis, but in Chicago and Philadelphia and New York, Washington, D.C., Detroit. And it almost runs simultaneously where if you go to all the above-mentioned catchment areas, individuals will articulate they know someone who has been brutalized or someone that has been killed by the police. And so I think, once again, this highlights an opportunity for us to really call for not just investigations, but how we can be proactive in establishing and organizing cop watch programs, civilian review boards. And this is why I always tell people, this is why it's essential to become jurors. Because if this goes to trial, you want to have people who understand things of this nature, and they see it not just from a racial lens, but they see it from a lens of why is it that police are using excessive force as it relates to one side of the color line, specifically black and male.
I want you to introduce us, if you can, to Michael Brown as a person, the victim who was shot and killed. Who is he?
I don't know Michael Brown, the person, only from what I've read, but we know of his age. We know of some of his friends. We know of some of the things he interacted in. We know of this area of St. Louis. We also understand that there are some who may not see Michael Brown from a perspective of young black male. They may see him from a perspective of young black male and dangerous. And so the psyche of pathology that some have as it relates to black males leads them to think you don't belong in this gated community, a la Trayvon Martin, Oscar Grant. I mean, the list goes on and on. What we do know is from the narratives, not my narrative, but the narratives of what his mother has shared, what his stepfather has shared, was that, you know, it's a family and it's a community that's grieving, you know. And so, you know, I haven't done extensive research in trying to figure out what type of, you know, school he attended, what type of grades he got. But the reality is, when we're looking at humanity, all of that isn't significant. What we have is a 18-year-old black male killed, something went awry, and we need to do a full-scale investigation And we need to find out, why is it that cops continue, or some police continue, to use excessive force? What we do know is that he had a heart. We know that it beat it. We know that he had parents. We know that he had friends. I would imagine from a developmental stage at 18, he may have loved a certain aspect of music. He may have been into avant-garde jazz, maybe not hip-hop. We know that he probably interacted with some of his friends in the community. Could have been basketball, could have been football, could have been karate. Whatever he was, or whatever he could have become, will no longer be, just like Trayvon Martin. So the possibilities of an 18-year-old will never be realize because he was shot down.
Now, the FBI, according to the New York Times, has opened their investigation of this. What do they need to do to make the community feel that justice is being served?
Well, when situations like this happen, you have the trauma, and I would imagine that it's already probably trauma that has existed well before that. I think it has to be fair. It has to be impartial. I think it has to be testimony that comes forth. And I'm not really certain how you calm the fears of a community that more often than not historically sees the police as a occupying terroristic force. If you look at the New York incident, those police that were part of that killing of Eric Garner saw him as the boogeyman. Big black guy, how do you tame him? He dies. He didn't have a gun. You know, this young man, we're still looking at reports, so we don't know what happened in this altercation. I think what the FBI has to do, and others, is they have to give the data to the community. They have to be transparent. They can't maintain status quo, not saying that that's what they're going to do. And the truth has to emerge. Who's going to bear the truth of this killing, of this death? And then I think from there we get proactive to see how we can put measures in to better work, not just with the police, but also we need to work in communities around diversity training, because not all cops see black males or other males in the light of the way we've been seeing that has swept the country. But this is a problem. This is a profound problem that needs to be addressed.
Are there programs out there already that help police forces interact with communities, that focus on diversity training, that help to humanize both sides?
Wonderful question. I would imagine that various police departments have it here in the city of Philadelphia, that oftentimes is not a city of brotherly love or sisterly affection, with not only police brutality, but the carnage of, you know, crime that we see in the city of Philadelphia. We do have organizations that work with that. The police department, they oftentimes bring in diversity experts to work on things of this nature. I'm not certain what St. Louis does. I'm certain that they can probably speak to that, but I think it's essential. And I think it's essential for both sides, because once again, just a disclaimer for your listening audience, we're not saying all police officers. We would not want to stereotype or generalize those officers on every side of the color line, and oftentimes white officers who are friendly and who are accepted within predominantly African-American and Latino communities. So we want to be very fair in that sense. But we also know that there are a few bad apples that will have us believing that we're going to paint all police officers the same way. One thing is consistent. Black males are dying at the hands of these police officers. And more often than not, the data that emerges is that they don't have a weapon. We're talking about unarmed individuals. And so that's what becomes problematic. And that's what you see when you see the anger, when you see the angst, when you see the people trying to find a way to speak back to the scars and suffering. Albeit it's not therapeutic in a sense when you're looking at looting and you're looking at individuals being upset. And so the community needs to dispatch what I call community interventionists to deal with the trauma, to deal with the grief, to deal with the bewilderment, to answer the questions, why my son? This mother has lost her son, who's 18 years old. The possibilities of possibly being a father, contributing to the society in whatever manner he was going to possibly contribute to the society, all is over, and that young man will be no more.
And as you said, this isn't just about St. Louis or Ferguson. It's not just about Trayvon Martin. It seems to be something that is occurring in various areas across the country. What would you like to see change, or what has to happen for people to get invested, and not just the people affected in that case, but the country, to seeing some sort of resolution and coming together?
I think media campaigns draw attention to injustice. So I think having the media campaign centered around this, Once again, I think getting on juries is really great. The establishment of civilian review boards, I think, is also something that can speak back to some of these challenges. And I think that's what organizing looks like. It looks like cop watch programs, similar to town watch programs. I think what it also we need to have happen is local organizations, not just the NAACP, but the ACLU and people of good moral standing on every side of the color line needs to say, hey, we're concerned about police killing black males. The same way we would be concerned about a white shooter in Aurora or Columbine or the individual Chen, who was down in Virginia Tech, who they knew that he had some mental health challenges. We need to pay attention to the lives of black males dying at the expense of police. We need for police to be friendly. We need them to understand diversity. We need to recognize that they shouldn't come in to a particular minority community viewing all black people through the lens of prejudice, through the lens of, you know, pathology. And what we also need to do is we need to have African-Americans tell more of their narratives of police brutality, because there's so much police brutality when I travel the country of individuals who have stated how they've been oftentimes oppressed and marginalized at the hands of the police, who oftentimes won't share those stories out of fear and retaliatory actions because they have to still live in these communities where these police are patrolling, not patrolling from a friendly standpoint, but once again, occupying terroristic force.
Chad, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I'm wishing that this community heals, the truth emerges. And once again, not all police officers should be painted in a negative light. And my prayers, thoughts, and reflections go out to this young man and all the other young men who have lost their lives. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you joining us today. That was Chad Dion Laster, professor of race relations at the University of Pennsylvania. He also sits on the board of trustees for the Philadelphia prison system, talking about a shooting that took place on Saturday. A young man named Michael Brown, and this happened in the town of Ferguson in Missouri.
I'm an INFP. Veronica is an ENFP. Not just a random string of letters. Those are our personality types, according to the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator Assessment.
A lot of organizations use that and other personality assessments to help employees understand themselves and one another. And as the idea goes, this helps people communicate and work better together.
Our next guest, though, isn't so sure about the effectiveness of the test. Joseph Stromberg joins us now. He's a science writer for Vox.com, where he wrote the piece, Why the Myers-Briggs test is totally meaningless. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, first, for people who haven't encountered this, so what is this Myers-Briggs type indicator?
The Myers-Briggs test is probably the most widely used personality test right now. And essentially, you take a series of questions, you answer a series of questions. Right now, it's 93 questions. Most of them give you one of two different possible answers. So it'll say, do you get energy from interacting with people, or do you get energy from staying at home? You answer your 93 questions, and it groups you into one of 16 different personality types.
And tell us, can you give us an example of some of the questions? Because one of the critiques that you have is that the test is binary. It's black and mm-hmm. white. You fall in one slot or the other. So can you give us an example of a question you may find on the test?
A possible question will say, you know, you find it easy to introduce yourself to other people. That's, you know, a question on an example test I'm actually looking at right now. and you say, I agree or I disagree. You're not really able to add any nuance to your answer. You can't say, well, it's easy to introduce yourself to people in professional settings, but not more social ones. Or sometimes I find it easy to introduce myself to people, but other times I'm a little more shy. You kind of just have to pick one or the other answer.
Right. A lot of times you might feel like you could go either way on some of those. Now, part of the reason we're talking about this particular test, and you wrote about it, is it's pretty widely used. How widespread is this?
The average estimate is about 2 million people take it annually. Mostly that's within corporate HR departments, sometimes colleges and schools. A number of government agencies actually use it. And generally this is used basically to sort people into different personality types. So an HR department can help guide you as to what types of fields you might be most successful in, what types of work you'll enjoy the most, things like that.
Now, one of the reasons that this test is so widespread is it sounds very official. It has it goes back a long ways, the Myers-Briggs mm-hmm. type indicator. But as it turns out, it sounds like the people who made this test up, who developed it, didn't have a lot of background, and the underpinnings, in fact, going back to Carl Jung, are a little bit, these days wouldn't be considered very credible. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the test?
Yeah. I guess you could say this test was state-of-the-art in 1921. As you mentioned, Carl Jung, his theories were pretty important for it. Essentially, he wrote a book called Psychological Types, and he was in many ways the father of analytical psychology. And he came up with all kinds of important theories that were really influential in the field, and one of them was this theory of types. So he thought humans could fall neatly into several different types, people who perceive the world first versus people who judge it first, people who prefer to sense it more logically versus people who intuit it on a more emotional level, basically making clean splits like that. And so that work was later picked up by a pair of Americans, Catherine Briggs and her daughter Isabel Briggs-Myers, which is why the test is the Myers-Briggs, and they translated that into an actual personality instrument. But the important thing was that even at the time, Jung said that these rules were just rough approximations and that most people were exceptions to them, and there was no way to actually cleanly split people into one or the other. But nevertheless, Myers and Briggs decided to take his types and turn them into an actual test instrument.
And now we take these tests at workplaces, in the military, you write, and somebody's supposed to be able to do something with them. You mentioned HR departments can help, in theory, help develop employees,
right,
things like that. You looked at some of the research out there, though. Is there research to back up the promises of this test?
There's actually not. The funny thing is, people in this field in psychology, they do have some systems they've developed in more recent years that they believe more accurately depict the different types of people there are out there. But there aren't working psychologists right now who use the Myers-Briggs to do that. The research that has been done shows that it's not a very accurate predictor of people's success in various fields or in people's, you know, it's, in some cases people claim that it can be used to predict, you know, what type of person you should marry, what type of people you should be friends with, things like that. And all the data says that it doesn't predict these things at rates any higher than chance.
Is it good if you just want to learn something about yourself? You want to put a figure on what your personality is like, get a picture of it that's clear, if you just want to use it for that kind of thing instead of any sort of tangible career-based information, for instance?
I think to some extent the comparison that I made that I think really hit a nerve with people is that it's kind of like a BuzzFeed quiz. It's fun to take.
Which Star Trek character are you most like or something
exactly,
like that?
Exactly right. And they're fun, and there's no harm in them, per se. Where the Myers-Briggs gets problematic is the fact that you have companies and government agencies paying lots of money, in some cases, to have people administrate this test. Essentially, it's overall the company that administers it, which is called CPP, makes an estimated $20 million every year, and the Myers-Briggs is its flagship product. And so, among other things, when someone wants to take the test, they charge between $15 and $40 to take it. They charge each person who wants to become a test administrator about $1,700 to take a four-day class to become a certified administrator. And so, to my way of thinking, there's nothing wrong with these tests if they're just a fun way to learn about yourself. But the fact that they're part of the infrastructure of so many corporations and government agencies when there's actually no scientific backing behind them is actually a problem.
And Joseph, we've got a little bit of time here, but one of the critiques you have of this is that it's all positive. It sounds as though there's nothing you can say that will displease the Myers-Briggs test, that you'll come up looking kind of rosy any way you slice it.
You're never just a jerk.
that's exactly right. And I mean, this is actually a trick used by palm readers and fortune tellers. If you vaguely say a lot of positive things about people, they'll generally have a nice experience when you read their palm or when they take your test. And that's one of the secrets to its success. And so, each of the different personality types, if you go read a profile, what is an ENTJ? What is an ISFP? All the things it says about these personality types are these glowing, beautiful things. You're a caretaker or you're an idealist. You're a leader. You never see that, you're a jerk or you're selfish. And so that's definitely one of the reasons the Myers-Briggs has been so successful. But it's also a reason why it's not as accurate in depicting the actual personality types we see in people.
We're talking about personality testing right now, especially about the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, with science reporter Joseph Stromberg. He says the test is totally meaningless.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you taken this test or used it in your business or other organization? Did it give you insight into yourself and your peers, or did you see it as a waste of time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with science writer Joseph Stromberg from Vox.com. We're talking about personality testing, in particular the Myers-Briggs test, and where it might fall short.
In a recent piece, our guest says this particular personality test is widely used but doesn't live up to its promises. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Have you taken or even maybe administered this test? How do you see it as being useful, or do you think it's a waste of time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Jenny on the line in Evansville. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I appreciate the topic. I took this test personally quite a while ago, and I took it from the book myself, so the elaborated version, because I think there are different versions of the test where there are more questions and then there's an abbreviated version. And I just wanted to say that I found it extremely useful, and I definitely would not call it meaningless or liken it to BuzzFeed or anything like that. However, I do appreciate, you know, what your guest is saying about the way that the test is used, and in terms of using it as a predictor or that sort of thing. But, you know, when I took it, I remember it saying, okay, my result was INFJ, and every INFJ person is not just the same, and that every letter, there's a continuum. You could be a strong I, you could fall anywhere on the continuum. So I didn't find it as black and white as your guest is stating. I also remember that a number of different questions in the questionnaire were kind of getting at the same thing. Mm-hmm. So even though the answers were black and white, you know, you had to pick A, B, C, D, they were repositioned.
Starting to break up there, Jenny, but thanks for the call. I think we see where you were going. So not quite so black and white, she says, Joseph, and she agrees maybe not a great predictor for the workplace, but a great starting point for some personal insight.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said before, if someone wants to take this on their own, there's obviously nothing wrong with that. I just don't see it as a useful tool that, you know, companies should be spending money on and that someone, you know, who wants to work for an organization should be subjected to, given the lack of research behind it. And as I said when I first got on, there are other personality indicators out there that have been developed much more recently based on actual data collected on real people. And those sorts of things have proven to be more accurate in terms of describing how different people differ from each other. One thing that I didn't mention earlier is that, you know, there are some traits among humans that have what's called a bimodal distribution, where you have some people at one end and some people at the other, and you have many more traits where everyone is more in the middle, like a bell curve. And the traits measured by the Myers-Briggs, which are, you know, as I said earlier, the introverted versus extroverted, or the judging versus perceiving, those sorts of things people have found tend to be more like a bell curve rather than two split groups who differ strongly from each other. So if you do want to take a personality type test, there are better ones out there. That said, if the Myers-Briggs is what floats your boat, that's fine too.
Well, just real quickly, what do you think is better than Myers-Briggs?
The one system that comes up most often is called the five-factor tool. So it measures people among what are called five big personality traits. Their openness, conscientiousness, agreeableness, neuroticism, and extroversion. And these are things that, again, psychologists have recently found to sort people more accurately in terms of being able to split people up into two different groups. And importantly, there are things that don't change as much over time. So as I was talking about the questions in the Myers-Briggs, how a lot of them you might answer one way some of the time and another way another part of the time, these other five traits in general seem to be a little more consistent. Now, that said, there's a lot of disagreement within psychology about the usefulness of personality types as a concept at all. And there are a lot of psychologists who think that it's more accurate to talk about personality states rather than personality types because people vary so much over time based on their circumstances.
I want to go back to the phones now. We're going to take a call from Andrea in Madison. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I understand the Myers-Briggs is actually a developmental test where if you take it young, you may have a preference like left-right-handedness, but then over the course of time and in maturity, other facets that are exist in all of us will begin to emerge and allow you a more multifaceted approach to things. And what I'd like you to speak to is the fact that I have found it inordinately useful on several occasions to facilitate communication, whether it's in a work group or relationships, where you've got different types of people having real difficulties understanding or communicating with one another. Can you address that?
All right. Thanks a lot, Andrea. And Andrea's saying it's a developmental tool that changes over time, and it can be a communication tool. What about that?
Well, I think she's right in saying that people's types do change over time. One of the biggest criticisms of the test is that when someone takes it and then takes it a second time, on average, 50% of the time they'll end up with a different personality type. And so to me, I don't see that as a benefit of the test, but kind of a problem, given that it claims to be a personality test that isolates people's personality types. To me, I see a test that people change in their assessment over time, not going to, you know, she's saying it's helpful in terms of communicating with different people. And again, I'm not going to dispute that in individual circumstances, people can get something out of it. I'm not saying we should outlaw this test or anything like that. I'm just mainly pointing out that there are much more, you know, scientifically accurate personality tests out there now that have been developed over the past few decades. And the Myers-Briggs compared to those is pretty outdated.
Andrea, thanks for the call. We'll go to Brian in Madison now. Brian, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to let them know that I'm a clinical psychology student at the University of Indianapolis. And I just finished taking coursework in personality testing. And I have to agree with them that the Myers-Briggs doesn't, you know, tell you a whole lot, and it is subject to change with retesting. But my question is where do you stand on more scientifically backed personality tests, such as the MMPI-2 or the NEOPIR? Being used for screening for in the infrastructure of business or something like that. I personally disagree with it, but the MMPI-2 being developed in the University of Minnesota has been a very widely and respected personality test that is used not only for clinical inference, but for screening of potential employees. And I was just wondering what your opinion was on that.
Thanks for calling in. That's actually a question in general about different types of personality tests that I've been asked a lot since writing this piece about the Myers-Briggs. And to be honest, I don't have as strong an opinion on those as I do about the Myers-Briggs. It seems that there's a lively debate going on within psychology about the usefulness of those types of tests. And I've spoken to psychologists who fall on both sides of that debate. And so, you know, that's a tough question, and that's being sorted out right now within the literature. It's much easier for me to look and say that Myers-Briggs is useless because of how definitively the data comes out down against it. In terms of the other more recent tests, it's a much more nuanced picture, and I think we're still trying to figure that out.
All right, well, thank you so much for the call, Brian. And, you know, you talked about how you thought Myers-Briggs was state-of-the-art in 1921. Why has it persisted all these years, and why does it still have cultural cachet?
That's an interesting question. One of the psychologists I talked to said that it's pretty unsuccessful as a personality test, but it's an extremely successful advertisement for itself. And so one of the reasons is, as we talked about, it gives everyone fairly positive results. It gives neat, easy-to-remember names and four-letter codes for each of the 16 personalities. It's kind of a well-packaged product that can be sold successfully. And one of the reasons that it's been sold successfully also is that there's one particular corporation behind it that bought the rights to it in the 1970s, this company called CPP. and they've marketed it very well. They have a whole infrastructure in place that people can become licensed to give the test. It's been part of various HR departments' traditions to give the same test every year for decades. And it's kind of a case where you have the scientific body of people working on human personality going in one direction, but then the public being sold a product that's in a very different direction.
Joseph, before we let you go, do you know your type?
I actually don't. I've been asked this a lot since writing about the test as well. And I've gotten different results different times I've taken it. So I'm, you know, not really confident that I have one particular type on this test.
All right, Joseph, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That was Joseph Stromberg, science writer with Vox.com.
Yeah, I took the test not all that long ago and found out the only strong result was I was an introvert.
Right, which explains why you're in radio.
Well, no, I didn't need the test to figure that out. Yeah, you know. But that's the thing, too. You're supposed to be able to overcome your own introversion or whatever it is and make your way in the world. Anyway, introvert. You heard it here first.
And I'm very mildly an extrovert. See, it is fun to talk about. You have to give it that.
It's true. That's true. Well, coming up in Wisconsin Life, we're going to have a fun conversation. We ask what you would miss about Wisconsin if you had to leave the state. Call in now with your answers at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. It's time for Wisconsin Life. What happens when you take the Wisconsinite out of Wisconsin? In just a moment, we'll visit some New York restaurants that have one answer to that question. And we want to hear from you. If you left Wisconsin, what would you miss the most? Or if you have left, what do you miss? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Going now to New York City, off a busy street in Greenwich Village is a cluster of restaurants known as Little Wisco. Owned and operated by Wisconsinites, these restaurants celebrate the spirit of the state. Producer Aaron Kloon went to talk with Wisconsin expats Adam Benedetto and Brian Bartels.
I think that the common thread is that the kind of answer that John Lennon would give is in that, like, if you lived in Roman times, you'd live in Rome, right? Like, this is the center of the world, and it's tough not to be here. But all of us came through our own kind of directions. Like, Gabe graduated from the University of Wisconsin, and was like, I want to move to New York, and I want to start a series of restaurants. And so then, once I got here, Gabriel had just opened Joseph Leonard, and he was like, you know, I want to keep my Wisconsinites close to home, and so he offered me a job. Joseph Leonard is actually the third restaurant that Gabriel opened in New York. It wasn't until Joseph Leonard started that the Wisconsin thing really developed, and that's because he hired three sisters that all were from northern Wisconsin, the Steger sisters, and he hired Matt Kebekus, who was from Madison, and then I'm from Wausau. So pretty much the whole staff was from Wisconsin. And then I was maitre d'ing, so like 5 to 6 nights a week, I was working the front door, and I have a tattoo of Wisconsin on my forearm. Every night, I'd be shaking hands with people, and they're like, you guys are so nice. Where are you from? And I'm like, well, we're from Wisconsin. That's, like, what we do. And then there's another bar down the street, which we don't own, but it's a Wisconsin bar called Kettle of Fish. The West Village is kind of a unique part of New York in that it's built to a human scale. A lot of the buildings in this area are maybe 5 or 6 stories as opposed to, like, giant monolith buildings. So the people that live here all feel like they're in part of a neighborhood. Rebranding, you know, the West Village as Little Wisco, I think, is kind of endemic of the idea that other places bring culture to New York City. And so we've brought our culture, and New York City thrives on other people bringing culture to the city itself. Yeah, and all these restaurants have kind of grown out of a bunch of great restaurants in Madison that, like, you know, is a generation older than us. And we work for all those people, and now we're, like, you know, developing ideas that we were imparted with in Wisconsin. So I think it's fun.
Yeah, yeah. I'm never homesick. I live above the biggest Packer bar in the city. And every time I feel I miss, you know, my cousins and my family and my good friends back home, I walk a couple steps, and it feels like I'm in a basement in Fond du Lac.
The Wisconsin charms kind of come out slowly. We've got the Blue Book kind of stacked in with some other books over there, like Walt Whitman.
Adam has a Wisconsin tattoo on his under his sleeve. I have a badger claw necklace. I have a Wisconsin wallet. so it's kind of masked a little bit, you know. We're proud of where we come from, and I think we exhibit it in a genuine way that's not confrontational and hopefully doesn't feel contrived or unnatural in any way. And I think that's an important thing to distinguish.
You know, at the end of the day, you can have food and wine, and you have that at thousands and thousands of restaurants in the city, but it's this sense of community that we build and the sense of kind of interpersonal relationships that make this place thrive. And that we learned in Wisconsin, without question.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more info, wisconsinlife.org.
And now we want to hear from you. If you've moved away from Wisconsin, maybe you came back, what did you miss the most about the state? How did you recreate it? And did you rely on care packages of cheese and beer? Or if you are still here in Wisconsin, what do you think you'd miss the most if you left? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Straight to your calls now with Steve in Madison. Steve, you're on the air.
How are you doing this afternoon? I called in to talk about the psychology guy, but today we're done with that, so I decided to talk about Madison, or Wisconsin instead. I live in Madison. I was born here, and I work all over the world. I've probably worked in 70 countries. I've lived in Central America. I've lived in Tennessee. And the thing about Wisconsin that I find irreplaceable anyplace else in the world is the look of the land at this time of year when the corn is full. The grass is green, the fields are green, the rolling hills. I think there's something very centering about this place. Mm. It's like, I don't know, no other place. My wife's from Texas, and I don't think she would ever leave this place again. So it's, this time of year is just an exceptional time in Wisconsin.
That's great, Steve, but the tough thing is if you're somewhere else, that's not something you can package up and take with you. You got to be here to see it.
No. Yeah, and I think the centering that the land provides you is, I don't know, life-giving in some way.
Steve, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. Yeah. Appreciate it.
And one thing about this, the thing that was just on. My daughter's from Madison too, of course, as well. And she lived in Chile. She lived in Thailand. She lived in Malaysia. You know, dated a bunch of guys from all these different places. She lives in Brooklyn now. She went to Kettle of Fish that the guy was just talking about. Met a guy, Laris, at the Packer Bar in Brooklyn. That's who she ended up marrying. In Manhattan, that's who she ended up marrying.
So. Wow,
that's awesome. Thank you so much, Steve.
Birds of a feather stick together. Robins, I guess. That was a beautiful comment from Steve. Let's go to Jason in Sparta. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how you guys doing? I moved to Wisconsin when I was 12 years old from Jackson, Mississippi, and I couldn't think of living anywhere else. I moved away a couple times, but this is my home.
All right. What do you love the most about Wisconsin, or what did you miss when you were gone?
Just the hills and the weather. And you take it for granted when you live here, but when you move down to Mississippi, you've got two seasons. You know, you've got fall and summer. That's basically it. It's always hot down there, and the humidity is always crazy. And up here, there's just awesome, cool people. There's great scenery to look at. There's four seasons in a year. And it's just the people and the scenery keep me coming back every time
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jason. Going to remember his comments about the season when it's winter and we're all depressed and needing some inspiration about Wisconsin. But yeah, four beautiful, distinct seasons is a good one.
Thanks, Jason. We've got Earl on the line in Medford now. Earl, hi.
Hi. I would miss Madeline Island. It's full of history. It's got an island mentality, a great library, and only one in the world of Tom's Burned Out Cafe.
You cannot recreate that anywhere else.
Never,
Earl,
never, never.
Earl, thank you so much for the call. We are talking about what you would miss if you left Wisconsin or what you have missed when you've left the state. 800-642-1234 is the number. A couple lines just popped open if you got a busy signal. 800-642-1234 or the Central Time Facebook page.
And we've got a nice comment here from Amy on Facebook who says what she would miss is clean, fresh water to drink from rural wells is what I miss the most when I moved to Kentucky for 2 years. So Wisconsin's clean water, that fresh well taste. I know what she's talking about. It's a nice water we have here in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
Forget the beer.
And Barb on Facebook has a flavor she'd miss. Fish fries and Packer parties. That is one you can recreate elsewhere, though, as we heard in that Wisconsin Life piece. We'll go back to the phones now with AJ in De Pere. AJ, hi.
Hey, guys. How you doing? One of the things, the major thing that I would miss is the changing of the seasons. Mm. That would be just killer for me. I enjoy all the seasons. I really don't have a favorite, although last winter was a little too long and a little bit too cold. But it was I enjoy the changing of the seasons, but that's what I miss. That's what I would miss the most. And the Packers and the Brewers, and also the Badgers. Well, like now with the TV coverage, man, you can see them anywhere, anyway. So that doesn't really matter anymore. So, but the changing of the seasons, that would be a downfall for me.
AJ, thank you so much for sharing that.
Appreciate that. And we're going to go next to Ken in West Bend. Hi there.
Good morning or good afternoon. When I graduated from college, I moved to Iowa, and the thing I missed the most was that no bars were open on Sundays in Iowa.
Okay, I did not know that.
I lived in a small, they're open now, I lived in a small town called Beechwood, and you could tell exactly what religion everybody was by what time they got to the local tavern, because it was also the grocery store and the only place you could buy a newspaper on Sunday mornings.
All right, there you go, the taverns being open on Sunday. It sounds like they are in Iowa now, but that's something that Ken will miss about Wisconsin. Thanks a lot.
Ken, thanks. We've got Elizabeth on the line now in Nina. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, I just had to call in because I moved here to Wisconsin about 15 years ago. I lived all over the world because my dad was a soldier, and when we moved here, I was absolutely amazed, not only at the natural beauty, there's just nothing like it, but at the people and the fact that there's almost no crime. I've lived in my house for 5 years, and I still don't have a key to the front door. Not that I recommend that, but also I think the most important thing is how much people here in Wisconsin care about each other. There are lots of places you can go where they'll say hello on the street, but it's very rare to find a place where if you ask for help, everyone will drop everything they're doing and try to help someone, whether they know that person or not. And that's really unique about Wisconsin.
And that's kept here after moving here, you said 15 years ago?
Yes, and I love raising my children here. I just think it's the most wonderful place, and you couldn't get me to move anywhere else.
All right. Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling.
Wow, so much passion we're hearing from people. Yeah. I love it. Well, thank you so much for that, Elizabeth. Peter in Woodruff, you're next.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Because of a family tragedy, we lived in Colorado for 5 years, and we spend lots and lots of time in the mountains, roaming Colorado and enjoying the country there. But there's no water there. We miss the lakes unbelievably. We're from northern Wisconsin, and where we live in our county here, we're surrounded by 8,000 lakes. Just beautiful.
So, Peter, would you trade the mountains for the lakes of Wisconsin?
Never.
You keep the lakes. All right. Well, thank you.
Well, thanks to all of you for your calls. And you can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. Brad, Dense Woods, Wildlife, and the Pinokies. Beldar says Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, and the Northwoods. Hey, Marcia writes, WPR. I'm not just being cute. I really would miss public radio, Wisconsin style. Thank you so much for that, Marcia.